About what time frame are we talking about here in this study in Daniel? Do you remember from last week?
The middle 2000.
That's right. Remember, we said one way to kind of summarize human history to date, it's an oversimplification, but it's true, pretty true, is about 2,000 years of human history from the creation down to Abraham, call of Abraham. Then there's about another 2,000 from then down to the time of Christ. I actually have a little chart here that shows all that. First 2,000 goes to about right here. The chart is not to scale, as you can probably tell. First 2,000 comes down to Abraham. Second roughly 2,000 goes from Abraham all the way down through our Old Testament history down to the time of Christ. And the last 2,000 is from then to now. So we're dealing in this middle 2,000 years of human history that goes from Abraham down to the time of Christ. And the events recorded in the book of Daniel take place from about 600 years before Christ and for the next 70 years. Okay? It's a 70-year window, roughly, the events themselves. What's described in the book is much larger than that, but roughly this 70 years from 600 B.C. down for the next 70 years is about where we're going to be talking about in the book of Daniel. Now, as you can see on this chart, something significant happened right here, and that is the kingdom of Israel divided right there at about that point. Before it divided, well, after it divided, actually, just right after, it looked like this, roughly. It divided into two groups for a total of 12 tribes. 10 of them stayed together and formed a unit called Israel in the north. That's the orange that you see on here. They were headquartered here in Samaria. The other two tribes stayed together, and they were known as Judah. Judah and Benjamin were actually mixed together. And that's what you see here in the green. So when the kingdom divided, you have two kingdoms, one in the north called Israel, and one in the south called Judah. They divided following Solomon's death, primarily because his son, Rehoboam, was such a total loser that he screwed it all up and caused the division to take place right here. Now, that division was judgment upon Solomon from God because Solomon strayed from God, disobeyed God. He followed after 1,000 different women, and God said, "Do not follow after any women. They will lead you astray," and he did not. And so the kingdom was divided at the time of his son, Rehoboam, right here. He started the southern kingdom, and another guy named Rehoboam started the northern kingdom. This northern kingdom then lasted until about 722 B.C., at which time it was taken over by the Assyrians. Not the Syrians, the Assyrians. Different people. The Assyrian Empire is mainly what you see here in green, all this Mesopotamia stuff and even went on down into Egypt. They became a world empire during this time, and God used them to judge that northern kingdom, the orange on this one here. He said, "I'm going to take the orange away," and he did. And he did it through the Assyrians right here in 722 B.C. because of their disobedience to God. So the northern kingdom lasted from the time of the split here, about 930 down to 722, and they ceased to exist, the northern kingdom. So what we were left with after that is just the southern kingdom. And I'll show you kind of what that looked like. Look like this. This is about all that's left. Do I need to put the boundaries on there? Can you figure that out okay? I'll just show you real quick. Look like this. That's all that was left. Northern 10 tribes are going into Assyrian captivity, and all that's left is Judah and Benjamin there in the south. They too became disobedient. And there was a principle, an operating principle of their life and of their times that said obedience brings blessing and disobedience brings judgment. Deuteronomy chapter 28, by the way, develops that idea at length. And they were disobedient too. So God sent another people to judge them. And that people was, who was that? Yeah, the Babylonians. Now the Babylonians are kind of right in the same general area that the Assyrians was in. They took over this region here. And they were primarily headquartered and functioning there. They started worldwide conquests and were opposed by Egypt down here in the south. So at the time of Daniel, you have this northern kingdom of Babylon fighting this kingdom of Egypt down here. And who's right between them? Judah, Israel. What's left of Israel, which is Judah. So here you got these two major powers fighting one another, and then you got these little guys standing in the middle of the highway. Well, these guys, Judah, hooked their wagon to the wrong team. They sided with Egypt against Babylon. So they became an enemy of Babylon because of their lack of trusting in God. They trusted in Egypt to protect them. So they sided with Egypt. And Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the head of Babylon, he came down through here in one of these conquests and decided he would just siege them as well and take them over. And he started all of that in about 605, 606 BC, roughly 600 BC, roughly. And it took him three sieges to actually finally knock Jerusalem down. He started it in about 605, came back 10 years later in 595, and came back 10 years after that in roughly 585. I'm rounding off now. It's just a little bit off there. Until finally he knocked the city down and took it captive. Well, in the first siege in about 605 BC, he took some people captive during that time, and included in that bunch of captives was Daniel, a guy named Daniel. Okay? So Daniel has been taken captive in the destruction of Judah right here. This is the end of the siege in 586. It started in 606, 20 years earlier. So in that time frame right there, 600 years before Christ roughly, Daniel gets hauled down to Babylon. Now Babylon was the idolatry capital of the universe. Israel was not to participate in idolatry at all. But because they did, God is rubbing their face in it. He says, all right, you guys want to disobey me. You're going to keep building up all of these idolatrous worship centers. I'll give you a little taste of that. So he took them captive by Nebuchadnezzar and was, in essence, planted in the most idolatrous place you can think of, Babylon. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand. The Lord gave his people to Nebuchadnezzar, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, that's Babylon, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Now what he's doing here by taking these vessels from God's house and moving them into his house, he's saying in effect, my God is bigger than your God. I just took your vessels. I took the things you used to worship him, and I put them in my house. So clearly, my God is bigger and better than your God, is the purpose of those capturing of those vessels. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, youths in whom was no defect. They were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving the king's court, and ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. See what's going on here? They took some of their captive Jews, and they're going to put them into a program to train them to serve in the Babylonian court. Now, why would he do something like that? That's good politics. That's good governance, is to take captive people and make them part of your administration, your country, your kingdom. Teach them your language, teach them your culture, teach them ways that they can serve you, and so you have your subservient peoples serving and working in the government of Babylon. Get the picture? Guess who is one of those guys who got picked for that program? That's what he's down there for. That's why he's there. Well, it might have looked like on the way down there that God had just dropped a nice big bag of lemons on Daniel because he'd been taken captive. He's a young man, by the way, maybe late teens. And he's been taken captive, and his life has basically turned to nothing. Anything that he hoped or wanted to do in life has just been taken away from him because now he's a captive of the Babylonian Empire. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. You see this deal? Whoever gets picked for this program gets a 3-year training program, all expenses paid by the government. They're trained in the different fields that they wanted them in, and they're guaranteed a nice, cushiony government job when the training is done after 3 years. This is like a Rhodes Scholarship with a guaranteed do-nothing government job for the rest of your life. Boy, those lemons don't look all that bad, do they? I'm starting to see some lemonade coming out of all of this. I'm starting to see Philippians chapter 1 all over again. Good things coming from bad circumstances is our main takeaway from Philippians chapter 1. What are we seeing here? Good things coming from bad circumstances for this Old Testament Saint Daniel. So among the ones chosen was from Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 4 young Jewish boys, and that's their names there. They're picked for this program. Man, this ain't looking all that bad to me. 3-year free education, all expenses paid. This is a full-blown scholarship, man. You don't have to do a thing but learn. And Daniel and 3 of his buds are picked in verse 6. So then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. Why'd he do that? Well, because they got Jewish names that reflect a relationship to their Jewish God. And the Babylonians don't want that. They want them to have Babylonian names that reflect a relationship to the Babylonian gods. And so they renamed these 3 guys, or all 4 of them actually. So Daniel got a new name, Belteshazzar. Hananiah got the new name Shadrach. Mishael got the new name Meshach. And Azariah got the new name Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the new names of these 3 friends of Daniel, and his name is Belteshazzar. So they get new names. So throughout the book, most of the time they're referred to by their Babylonian names. That's all it is just a change in names. It's a change in names that is supposed to reflect a relationship, a domination by, a submission to the Babylonian gods. So I don't know, man. So far this story, if I was Daniel, this story could have a much, much worse ending, couldn't it? Here he is now, taken captive by this heathen, godless Nebuchadnezzar, and yet put into a marvelous, wonderful opportunity that the world is offering him. 3 years of free education, guaranteed job afterwards, Man, that is a bird nest on the ground if I ever saw one. Don't stir the pot, Daniel, and mess up that opportunity. Would have been my advice. Go along to get along, Daniel. Keep your mouth shut, keep your head down, and take advantage of this wonderful opportunity. That's all you got to do. If you have to compromise a little bit along the way, okay, so what? God put you in that situation. It's not your fault that you might have to compromise a little bit. After all, He put you there. It's like Adam says, hey, that woman you gave me, she made me do it. You put me in this situation, God. I'm going to just kind of go along here. Verse 8, but, yikes. That word is usually a major U-turn, isn't it? But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. And wait a minute, Daniel. What big deal is it if you eat some meat that had been sacrificed to idols? So what? Who cares? It tastes the same. You won't know the difference. That smoked brisket is just the same whether it's been offered to an idol or not. It's still good. So why are you making some kind of a deal over this? This is just what you would expect from a senseless 17-year-old boy, isn't it? Foolishness. You expect a 17-year-old to do something foolish. 17-year-old boys pride themselves in doing things that are foolish. They're world-class knuckleheads at 17. It takes about another 20 or 30 years to get out of that phase, but eventually, most men do. So why is he stirring this pot? Well, there's an operating principle that is at work here in the Old Testament that says, if you'll be good, I'll bless you. The New Testament principle says, I've blessed you, now be good. But the Old Testament principle says, if you are good, if you obey, then I will bless you. Deuteronomy 28. If you don't believe me, go read that. And this choice that Daniel has to make here is whether he obeys God and does not eat meat offered to idols, or whether he doesn't obey God. So the choice for Daniel is, am I going to live by this divine principle of obedience brings blessing and disobedience brings judgment, or am I going to just blow that off and go along to get along? What am I going to do? And surprisingly, especially surprisingly for a 17-year-old male, he makes a good decision. When has that ever happened before or since? Daniel has got some character at a young age of life that is extremely impressive. How many 17-year-old males do you know that would make this kind of a decision? That's this wise. That's this dedicated to obeying God in his life. Paul makes the same decision basically in Philippians, but he's not a 17-year-old. He's got a little time to mature out there, but Daniel, he's a young man, a youngster. And he says, I'm not going to disobey God, even if it jeopardizes my bird nest on the ground here. I'm going to obey God. That's rather phenomenal. This is an impressive guy. Very, very impressive guy. In fact, there's a couple places in Scripture where he's mentioned in such a way that he's kind of without peer in his righteousness. And we see it at work in this early point in his life. He doesn't want to eat this meat that the king provides because it's been offered to idols. He doesn't want to drink the wine that the king provides because it's been offered to idols. He's not supposed to do that. He knows that. And he says, I don't want to do that. How many people would have made that decision with what's at risk? How many people would have risked this opportunity to obey God? Uh-oh. Starting to get a little loud next door, aren't they? I brought my dikes along so I can cut some wires if we need to. Sneak up in the ceiling there. Daniel makes a startling choice. And how does he go about enforcing his decision here? He says in verse 8, I'm still in verse 8. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. That's even more good insight, isn't it? Instead of just saying, well, puffing his chest up and ripping the buttons off of his shirt, he says, I'm not going to do what this guy says. But he goes about it in a way that is very wise and insightful. He seeks permission to not have to eat those things. Again, we're seeing judgment on the part of this young man that is very, very impressive. So he says, he goes to the head of the group there, and he says, could I maybe not eat what the king is offering us here and go about this in a little different way? And God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. God granted. Wow, that looks like God's right in the middle of this thing, doesn't it? This looks like divine providence at work to me, that God is he's stirring this pot. He's got control of these circumstances. He works through this guy that Daniel reports to and gives Daniel a good relationship with him, and this guy tries to work with him. He gives Daniel compassion and favor on the part of this guy. But the guy's got a problem. He says in verse 10, well, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than these youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. You see his problem? He says, look, if I don't make you eat the stuff that the king provides and you end up looking more peaked than the other guys, he's going to say, what's wrong with these guys? Ain't they eating what I'm providing? And the king would take it out. Nebuchadnezzar would take this guy's head off. So he's got a problem. He wants to help Daniel, but he's got a problem. But Daniel's got a suggestion. He said to the overseer, verse 11, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel and his three buds, please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. See his proposal? He says, look, we'll just eat veggies. Me and these other guys, we won't eat the king's meat that's been offered to idols. We'll just eat veggies. And we'll take about a 10-day window here, and we'll eat the veggies and let them eat whatever. They can eat the fat burgers, and we'll be vegans, and you check us out at the end of the 10 days and see how we all look. Good idea. So veggies and water instead of brisket and Coke is Daniel's diet. So that's what he proposes, and the guy listens to him. He said, all right, let's try it. So he listened to them in this matter, verse 14, and tested him for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine that they were to drink and kept giving them veggies. So the plan worked. Think there might have been any sort of a divine involvement in that? Of course there is. His hand is all over this situation. So Daniel's judgment is as good as his commitment and dedication to the Lord in this situation, and God blessed that And these guys are looking just as good at the end of the 10-day test as the other people. Where do you think this 17-year-old got this kind of character? From their peers? From hanging around with the buds down at the arcade? I don't think there's any choice whatsoever. Mom and Dad is where they got this. He got this character. His parents built into this young man marvelous character at a young age. It can be done, but it rarely is. Most parenting is just terrible that you see nowadays, and the product of that parenting is unfortunately terrible too. But godly parents can raise godly children. Daniel's parents did. And at the age of 17, he's making decisions and commitments and showing judgment that's remarkable for a young man. It would be remarkable for an old squirrel like me. But he's like 17. And he's showing this kind of judgment. Big time kudos for Mom and Dad for Daniel. So, this lemonade is coming together real well, like down there, isn't it? This bad situation is producing some very, very good results. And the Lord is clearly overseeing and superintending Daniel's life and bringing about these things, manipulating the detail and circumstances of his life, and taking care of Daniel business very nicely for him. So as for these four youths, verse 17, God gave, notice the cause and effect there, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. God gave these people, these four guys, particular mental and probably spiritual too, but at least mental insight. Their wisdom, their skill sets were divinely ordained. You see that? God gave them certain learnings and certain abilities and certain insights and all that stuff. That's why some of us can think real well in some areas and not so well in others, is because God gives us insight at times and the ability to learn and to do things. So God gave these four guys knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. This book is a book of visions and dreams. There's actually six of them in here. A couple of them had by Nebuchadnezzar and some of them had by Daniel. But this book basically revolves around six visions or dreams. Three of them in the first seven chapters and three of them in the last part of the book. And we're going to look through those. We're going to see all of those as we go through the book. But these six dreams or visions is the heart of this book. Six dreams, six visions. There's other stuff, of course, as well, but we're going to look through these as we go. The first three visions are sometimes referred to as being applied to what's called the latter days. The latter days. The latter days is the time frame from roughly Nebuchadnezzar's era here, 600 BC, down to the second advent. It's down here. From 600 BC down to when the Lord comes back at the second advent, not the rapture now, but the second advent, that's the latter days. It's mentioned here in Daniel. We'll see it in a bit. It's sometimes also referred to as the times of the Gentiles. And what that means is that there's a period of history when the Gentile peoples dominated and ruled over Israel. That's also the same window. From time Nebuchadnezzar did it right here, finished them off, down to the second advent. That's the time of the Gentiles. So the latter days And the times of the Gentiles is the same period of time, from roughly 600 BC down to the Second Advent. And these visions here, these first three, will give us a picture of that window of time. We'll get into all of that. Now, the last three visions have to do with Israel's prophetic history. What's going to happen to the nation of Israel from also about 600 BC down to the Second Advent? So one of them is sort of a worldwide political picture of what's going to happen there with the Gentiles, and the other three form a picture of Israel's prophetic history. Six visions that will give us, in essence, a profile of human history from Nebuchadnezzar's day down to the Second Advent. That's at least 2,600 years of history. What other book in the Bible gives you a panoramic view of 2,600 years of human history besides this one? None of them. This is the broadest, most encompassing picture of human history that you have anywhere, in any literature, anywhere, here in the book of Daniel. Daniel is skilled in understanding all of this. God gave him the ability to read and understand these dreams. So he's going to be the guy that will interpret all of this for us. That's why he gets to put his name on the book. He understands this stuff. He's going to explain it to us as we go. So God gave understanding of visions and dreams to Daniel. And he will be the guy that will explain all this to us. That's where we're headed. That's what we're going to see. We're not there yet. I can give you a little more detail on that, but we'll look at it later. You don't need it right now. Probably just bounce right off you right now anyway. All right, verse 18 of Daniel chapter 1. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, this would be like 3 years later, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. This is interview day. Show your stuff to Nebuchadnezzar, guys. And he's going to pick from you guys who he wants. And the king talked with them. And out of them all, not one of them was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. Good day for them. Good interview day. Face-to-face stuff. Not like now. If you don't have a key search word on your resume, nobody calls. They actually got to talk to somebody. They got to talk to Nebuchadnezzar. And he saw in these four guys a superiority in learning and intellect to the others that he interviewed, and so he pressed them right into government service. So here we go. 3 years after Daniel is taken captive by this guy, he's now working for him. He's part of the Nebuchadnezzar administration. And I doubt if he got the kind of news coverage that our administration gets today. Their heads would have been gone in an instant. So things have worked out wonderful for him. I'm seeing Philippians chapter 1 all over again here. I'm seeing good things come from bad circumstances all over again, just like Paul taught us there. And as for every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. All those shysters that Nebuchadnezzar had working for him couldn't come up with jack compared to what Daniel and his friends knew and understood, because they have the blessing of God on them. And so he stayed down there for more than 67 years later, but that's just mentioned here. Another 67 years. All right. Do you understand the setting of this book? It is a time of war. God is using nations to judge nations. He's using the godless nation of Babylon to judge his people, Judah, who's the only one left. Assyria has already been used to judge the northern 10 tribes. So it's a time of war. It's a time of judgment. Daniel and his friends have been taken captive down to that new kingdom as a result of that judgment. But God has prepared them and put them in a place to serve that godless king in the way that he wanted them to do. He's made the biggest pot of lemonade you can imagine out of that big bag of lemons that Nebuchadnezzar dropped on Daniel 3 years earlier. See the principle illustrated there? God brings about good things from bad circumstances. And Daniel's life illustrates that just as well as anybody. Joseph's does too. Ruth's does too. He ain't the only illustration, but he's probably the clearest one of them all. Any questions about the setting now? And Daniel's particular preparation and skills. He's going to interpret visions, and that's going to be the heart of the book. Six visions, and Daniel is the man. You want to know about visions? Call Daniel. Is where we're headed. Okay? Everybody cool? Everybody understand the setting and kind of general where we're heading? Dawn?
Have you run across anything that explains how Nebuchadnezzar, as king of Babylon, besieged Jerusalem, and then in his second year of his reign, he had dreams that Daniel interpreted? Daniel wouldn't have been there.
Yeah, that's the way they reckon realm is the first year of ascension you don't count in terms of his reign. So it's actually his third year.
Okay, but what about the siege on Jerusalem? I mean, that had to happen over a period of time.
Well, he started it in like 605, came back 10 years later and another 10 years after that. So in that first wave, he took Daniel with him. He's going back from Egypt to Babylon because his father has died. And he's taking over the realm. Nebuchadnezzar. His father's name was Neoplasser. He has died. And so Nebuchadnezzar is going back to Babylon to ascend to the throne. He takes Daniel and these guys with him as part of this siege. So they go back together. So that 3 years kind of starts right then. And then in the second year of his reign, which had been his third year, they don't count the first year. So the next 2 years is actually 3 years on the job. So Daniel's been down there 3 years. Okay. Any other questions about the setting? Okay. Chapter 2. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, this would have been Daniel's third year down there. First year doesn't count as part of your reign, so that's 3 years into Daniel's stint. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Now, this dream that he has here in chapter 2 is not the result of eating cold pizza just before going to bed. That can give you some bad dreams, too. This is clearly a divine act. Something has concerned him so much from this dream that he is bummed. This is not your average, everyday dream. Remember I told you we're going to see six visions or dreams? This is the first one of them. So he's concerned. There's something about this that really upset him. I'll show you a picture of what it is here in just a minute. So then the king gave orders to call in all the magicians and the conjurers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans, all these shyster prophetic guys that he had on staff, to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And he's pretty cool. Nebuchadnezzar's pretty sharp. He says to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. And so the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic and said, well, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. So they say, okay, tell us what you dreamed, and we'll tell you what it means. We'll look in our little user's manual for dreams from Nebuchadnezzar after you tell us what you dreamed, and we'll tell you what it means. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I don't think so. He said, look, what I told you is firm. If you don't make known to me the dream and its interpretation, I'll just cut you up in little pieces and make your houses rubbish heaps. That's what you call negative motivation. He knows that these guys can dupe him. So he says, I'm not going to tell you the dream. You're going to tell me the dream and its interpretation. So he's not as stupid as they might think. And if you can't do that, I'll just chop you up in little pieces and we'll make a dung heap out of your house. How's that sound? But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. Positive motivation. Pick whichever one you want, but you got to tell me what it's all about. And they start spitting and sputtering and not knowing exactly what to say. So they say a second time, well, let the king tell the dream to his servants and we'll declare the interpretation. You see what they're doing? They have no idea what he dreamed. They got nothing. So they're trying to get him to tell them the dream. Then they can make up an interpretation. He won't know. So he says to him in verse 8, chapter 2, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is not one, only one decree for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. He's got him between a rock and a hard place, doesn't he? Says, I know you guys are a bunch of lying rats. So tell me what I dreamed and its interpretation. And they say, verse 10, hey, you're asking too much, guy. There's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult. Hey, this is hard what you're asking here. We get a paycheck twice a month, but don't expect us to earn it. This is hard. And there's no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. And man, when they insulted him like that, he really got spun up. Verse 12. Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So they basically said to him, you're being ridiculous. Nobody can do what you want us to do. We're not going to do that. We can't do that. So he says, all right, we'll just chop you up in little pieces then. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. Now, Daniel and his friends were apparently in the same general category of aides to Nebuchadnezzar who worked in this area of interpreting dreams and this sort of thing. They were wise men in that general broad-based category. So when the command goes out from Nebuchadnezzar to kill all these phonies, they go to start rounding up all the other guys that are in this same category, of whom Daniel and his three friends were. So now, that lemonade's looking like lemons again, isn't it? It's a bad situation again. Now he's in a life-threatened situation because of these morons that work for Nebuchadnezzar. So, the situation looks hopeless. Nebuchadnezzar didn't exactly have any restraints on him. He said, you're dead. So the situation looks really bad. But Daniel, in verse 14, replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Discretion and discernment on the part of a 20-year-old. Again, impressive. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Now, clearly, Daniel has already a position of high regard by Nebuchadnezzar. He couldn't just walk into him and say, give me a little time here and I think I can help. You can't just walk into that guy. Clearly, Daniel is already in a position of confidence and admiration from Nebuchadnezzar to be able to do that. So he goes in and he asks for a little time from Nebuchadnezzar and said, let us work this thing a little bit. So he goes home and gets his friends together and they have this prayer meeting. Verse 17. In order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So he goes and gets his buds together. They turn to God and ask for understanding to preserve life here. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So God used another dream to explain to Daniel what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was. This is a book of dreamers, isn't it? Dreams going on everywhere. And then Daniel then blessed or praised the God of heaven because God had given Daniel the answer to his prayer that he sought, that is, understanding of what this dream was all about that Nebuchadnezzar had. And he said, well, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs. Daniel understood the superintending providence of God. He removes kings and he establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and then the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power, for even now thou hast made known to me what we requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. So Nebuchadnezzar's dream has now been revealed to Daniel. Now, how in the world did he manage to get to sleep that night to have this dream? Daniel, that is. Might be a little spun up about this time, mightn't you? Huh? Since someone just decided to cut your head off. But he did. He got to sleep, and God revealed it to him in his dream. What is going on here? Well, I guess we're going to have to throttle back here. You think you can hold this dream in the back of your mind for another week? Yeah, it's a little too much involved. We can't cover it in 5 more minutes. Any questions about what's going on here? We haven't seen the dream yet, so you don't know exactly what to ask about it. But do you have any questions about how God is working through Daniel so far? And you can see his providential care on Daniel's life through this situation. Daniel is a guy who... Yeah, Serena.
Daniel a rich man?
Well, after the training, he was probably pretty well off. As a youth going down there, he might have been among the nobles. So he might have been okay before he went. But afterwards, he's... upper white collar for sure. But he's a guy who illustrates very clearly in his life that you can live a godly life in a godless environment. Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon was about as godless as you can get. Yeah, Mary?
So is this obedience, is this what brings on God's favor to people?
In the Old Testament era, absolutely it was.
I'm not talking about the Old Testament necessarily.
Obedience is always good in the New Testament era as well. But remember, in the New Testament era, the operating principle is a little different. It is, I have already blessed you, now obey me. See, we have already been blessed with every spiritual blessing from the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. So we already have all we're going to get spiritually. Now, does that mean if we obey God, we're going to be rich? No. That doesn't mean that necessarily.
What I'm saying is, yes, I know I'm already saved, but themselves?
No, no. In fact, your obedience to God will probably bring on their hatred toward you. Anybody that will live righteously in this present age will suffer persecution. But it will bring on God's favor on your life. You can expect His blessings on your life. But no, not the world's. They will probably make you their enemy, because a friend of the world is the enemy of God. But we are to obey anyway and expect God's blessings on our lives. They may not be material, probably won't be, but they'll be more spiritual than material, probably.
But He is stronger and smarter than the world, so I'd rather get God's favor.
yeah, that's true. It's the same. It's the George Beverly Shea syndrome that we talked about. I'd rather have Jesus than anything this world affords today. That sort of thing. But in Daniel's day, it was very much obedience brings blessing and disobedience brings judgment. That was the operating principle under the old covenant. And that's why he has chosen the course that he has here. He's chosen to obey God.
Well, the reason I ask is because I know that I feel at times a lot of favor from God. And even as a sinner that I am, you know, I feel a lot of, I've had a lot of favor, and I just wonder why. Why God would choose me, or why God would choose Daniel to be... Well, I know why he'd choose Daniel, because he's obedient, but...
Well, the same principle applies, though, in the New Testament as an indication or proof of our discipleship is our obedience to God. It's always a sign of sonship. Obedience is a sign of sonship or childrenship to God. So we should always be obedient. We can expect God's blessings on our lives. They're not always material, though. That's the thing I'm just trying to get everybody to make sure they understand. Your blessings from God may be of a spiritual nature rather than a material one. In this day and age, but we should always obey God, always seek to obey God, and you can expect His blessing on your life. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll get into the vision next time, and press on then. So we'll let you roll, and see you next Sunday, Lord willing.